Still, Queer As Folk. Tonight, Dr. David climbs on top of Michael, and Brian gets naked with a client. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This episode is called Now Approaching the Line.
First aired on Showtime in the U.S. on January 7th, 2001.
It was written by Jason Schaefer and directed by Kari Skoglund. She directed three episodes of Queer as Folk across three different seasons, and she went on to direct episodes of House of Cards, The Americans, The Walking Dead, Boardwalk Empire, and my favorite, Children of the Corn, 666, Isaac's Return.
I'm sure that's the crowning achievement on her career.
I think it was straight to video.
No, that's kind of amazing. You know, she, having only done three episodes of Queer as Folk, but has managed to hit every major, you know, American drama that's happened in, you know, the past 17 years is really impressive. Well, on to what the episode is about. Now approaching the line, Michael fends off the romantic interest of Tracy, the female coworker, who doesn't know he's gay.
Surprise. Do not know.
And instead dates a handsome chiropractor.
Yes.
Can't wait.
Well, Dr. Brian, David.
Doctor.
Give Is me that a name. Spoiler?
Foreshadowing.
Yes.
Instead, he dates a handsome chiropractor while Brian is propositioned by a potentially lucrative client of his firm, which I just thought was his MO.
Is that Marvin?
Marvin. And Justin struggles to repair his fractured relationship with his mother.
Oh, what else is new?
Right? He's a teenager. He already has a fractured relationship.
This show opened up with a cute little scene in Brian's loft where we wake up to a beefcake in Brian's bed with him, and the beefcake, or no, Brian rolls over and says,
"Who the hell are you? I'm the guy you fucked last night.
I'm the guy you fucked last night." That's cute to you, Patrick. That's a cute opening.
I thought
that's trashy to me.
It's never happened to either of us, has it?
No.
Never.
Never.
I like the look on the beefcake's face, though, and he had this kind of little physical moment where his head just like peaks up, because first there's a single shot of Brian, and then all of a sudden it's a double of Brian and the beefcake, and he just peeks up like, huh?
And what I particularly love, so the only reason they wake up is because there's a bang at the door. And it turns out Lindsay is there unexpectedly with Gus.
Yeah, does she have walk-in privileges at the street level of Brian's loft? How do all these people just get right in through the locked door?
I mean, I'm going to assume it's like any other apartment building. You might just get lucky and someone's walking out and you just walk right in.
Very opportunistic of them.
Very much so. But what I love is that this beefcake, as he's getting dressed, goes over and he sees Gus, and he does the most adorable baby talk.
Precious. Hello.
Hello. Oh, baby. Hello, baby. Hello.
And as soon as he clocks Brian looking at him, he immediately like goes super mask. He's like, "Let's do it again."
Yeah.
And I was like, that's a choice.
Yeah. I thought the beefcake was a little off type for Brian, because we see Brian with a wide assortment of men throughout the show, but this guy just didn't look like somebody that Brian would bring home with him. Or let stay the night, I guess.
Well, I think that's when he woke up. He was surprised to see. That's why he asked, "Who the fuck are you?" Yeah. He's like, "Who are you and why are you in my bed?"
Yeah.
But so Lindsay has decided to show up and in an effort to try and help the relationship along between specifically Brian and Mel, to invite him to dinner on Friday night early enough so he can still hit the bars, which I think is very considerate.
With her chicken with like 45 cloves in it.
That's a lot.
Yeah. What is that chicken going to taste like?
Jeez.
That sounds terrible.
That's a lot.
I thought that scene was just kind of like a little setup though, to really tee up the Melanie and Brian animosity, because she just shows up and invites Brian to dinner. So it just seemed like it didn't really have any part of the story other than to invite Brian over for dinner.
Oh yeah. I think there's multiple moments in this episode, particularly where a lot of things were just built in for convenience to like make the story move along rather than like come from an organic place.
Yeah.
So I think this is one instance where it's like, well, we need to set up a conflict right away. So here's the conflict. We're going to put Brian and Mel in the same room again.
Yeah. And like we talked about in the last episode with the theme of the three mothers, I was trying hard early on to find a theme and nothing was just jumping right out at me. And it took a while for the episode to play out before I had any idea why all this was happening. So the first bits of the show seemed just a little kind of throwaway to me. They were funny, but
yeah, they were a little slapdash. I think it takes getting probably 3/4 of the episode for what they were going for to emerge. And mm-hmm. I think if you then play it back, we then understand like, oh, this is what you were going for. So when we get there,
yeah,
we'll be able to, I think, tie this up.
I think the first meaningful part, which I guess was another tee up, was at the big queue where Tracy is no longer calling Michael Mr. Novotny. And there's just that quick scene where she volunteers to work lately. We have Marlene, the caddy clerk.
Who, in her little bit scene with the coupon lady, I was a big fan of her. She was dishing it out for anyone who works for customer service, and it was fantastic.
I have 35 cents off the kitty bites.
Oh, we do coupons at the end, and that one expired in 1992.
Honey, you would love gay men. Like, yeah. They would love how you just read everybody. They would live for it.
Good fag hag material from yes. Caddy Clerk.
Well, I prefer the term fruit fly to fag hag.
Okay.
Maybe that plays into the theme of the generational difference, Patrick.
Oh, yeah, that could be a theme. So meanwhile, Justin and his mother are doing some bizarre form of group therapy, which I didn't know that there was any such therapy that would happen like that, where there's Justin, who they are trying to reprogram into a straight and or try to understand him, actually in therapy with his mother. Does that happen?
I'm pretty sure it does, but that's the thing. I don't think it was a reprogramming. I don't think she was trying to force him to be straight. I think she was just, I think it is more of an effort of just trying to understand him. And I think by kind of getting him in a room where he can not run away, and I think she was trying.
Yeah.
And I think.
I just thought it was strange that his mother was with him, because who would open up to a therapist with your mother in the room?
Well, I think we have to take it as a almost like a sort of couples therapy, you know, like
interesting
in order for, you know, to make it feel like there's a safe place because there's a not an unbiased third party in the room. So, you know, Jennifer can have her say on how she's feeling. So then we can open it to Justin and they can both feel like they can speak their minds.
It was a weird way to stage this up that they had to do it with a therapist, though. Don't you think that there could have been a little more drama if maybe they were having that conversation in the car on the way to Nike Town?
That's possible, but I think it shows that that was the step needed to take, because he would run away. He wasn't staying home. He wasn't opening up to her. So instead, what does she do? She's like, I would have been interested in seeing the scene of her getting him in the car to go to the therapist.
Yeah.
Because I highly doubt he would have said, okay, I'll go to the therapist with you. I'm sure he thought he was going to school or something. And she said, okay, we need to stop here first. Next thing you know, he's in the therapist. That's the scene that would have been interesting to see. Because I don't think Justin would have gone there willingly.
Right. He was definitely, it was almost like a hostage video type of thing with Justin.
Oh, yeah.
And Jennifer's giving all the usual reasons that parents come up with.
Right. He's 17. He doesn't know who he is yet. And I'm like, no, actually, he's in prime position to know who he is.
Well, maybe that's why the scene did work in the end, because if you're gay and you're watching it, when you're 17, you kind of have all those answers. And it's the drama that Jennifer's bringing to it. You see that Justin really has kind of the upper hand in it. And he shows that when he does this wonderful speech of his
how does he know he's gay?
I like dick. I want to get fucked by dick. I want to suck dick. I like sucking dick. And I'm good at it, too.
His confidence was a little bit off there, because it doesn't track, like him saying that to his mother and to this therapist, doesn't track with him jumping out of the car like a day earlier.
Oh, well, I don't know how we know.
Maybe
how
he found
much time.
His mojo.
Right.
Well, got his game.
Right. I think he's gone from confidence to cockiness to now he's in like full rebellion, and it's as if he's trying to assert his independence from his mother.
Yeah.
I think something tells me that they were always very close. I think it's key to what Jennifer mm-hmm. says later on in the diner with Debbie. It's like he's purposefully pushing her away and lashing out at her and being incredibly crude and rude in front of a what would be a total stranger, you know, with this therapist.
Yeah.
And asserting that, like, no, this is who I am, and you're just going to have to fucking take it.
I did like the therapist character. She was just, like, in air quotes, therapist.
So. Right. Just very, like, because, like, her reaction after Justin very clearly states that he is a fan of the penis.
And he's good at it.
And he's revels in it. She's very calmly... Looks like he's like, well, yeah. There's that.
I thought Debbie worked as a much better therapist. We'll get to that scene in a little bit. So while all this is going on, Brian is yet another pitch meeting. He's pitching a product, obviously pointed at men again.
Did it have something to do with NASCAR? Because I could have sworn there was something like that involved, or something that obviously a very masculine.
Yeah, he's making the pitch to Marvin that they need to appeal to speed and masculinity.
Yes.
And of course, Brian seems to only be able to sell product to men.
Target males, of course, 18 to 34, feature speed, fashion, visibility. You sponsor a NASCAR team, but you need a campaign to max the investment.
So this scene was really just to introduce Marvin and to get Marvin kind of out of the way for the moment to be able to reintroduce him later.
Well, no, they really took an opportunity to make him an antagonist to Brian in this first meeting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's not interested in what the firm can offer in terms of
baseball
perks.
Tickets on and the first baseline.
Like, I'm tired, you know.
Yeah, I have a lot of meetings.
And Brian, like, as soon as Marvin leaves, Brian is very clear. Like, we know exactly what he wants, and he doesn't want anything to do with us. He wants all of our ideas, and like, so it's very clear that Brian is not going to work to get Marvin in this firm the way he got his previous client.
Yeah. I did like how Brian turns on straight mode where he's like,
oh my gosh.
I know a great chop house.
I know a great chop house.
Do you like steaks?
Yeah. And it makes sense because, you know, Brian is very much trying to not be categorized as the gay advertising executive. And so he's very much himself. But when he does it, it comes off as like very strange sounding because remember this morning we saw the guy who got fucked last night.
Right. The beefcake.
Beefcake. Yeah. Beefcake.
Is that what it's called on IMDb?
I don't know. I didn't look him up. We should.
Oh my God. I'm going to have to do that. Let's keep rolling, but I really want to look that up.
Unfortunately, there wasn't an underwear check in that scene.
There wasn't because I mean, Beefcake was definitely not wearing underwear.
Yeah. So then we mysteriously find ourselves at the diner all of a sudden. And I do like how the diner is used to fill gaps and to set up other arcs. It's kind of the launching point for a number of stories. And they really set up who's going to do what, who just did what. And it gives Debbie a moment to come in and preach a little bit.
Right. Beefcake is actually credited as Tattoo.
Ah.
Which is crazy to me because he had like one tattoo. Like,
yeah, it wasn't a very good one.
Yeah, which I would have much just called him Beefcake. Yeah. Let's just be honest.
We'll call him Beefcake
from that one.
In the diner, it's unclear how much time has passed since the last episode. It's almost set that not much time has passed, but Ted seems to have made an astonishing recovery from being in a coma from being poisoned by your favorite, Matt, Blake.
At the time, he was a favorite. And you know what? Ted does share some of the blame for taking drugs from a stranger.
Yeah, Brian told us about taking drugs with people other than your friends. So
So yeah, I'm not quick to blame Blake for that. I agree. There's, I'm like, that's such a, it was just a little coma, just a little one, you know?
Well, it did only last one episode, so.
Not even the whole episode.
Yeah. His total screen time was probably 20 minutes of coma time.
Mm-hmm.
And he snapped right out of it. And now he's back in the game, even though he does say that a lot of his past activities are no longer deductible expenses.
In light of my recent near-death experience, I have decided to take account of my near life. Woody's in Babylon are no longer deductible expenses.
Which they got to shoehorn in. Yeah, shoehorn in the accountant. There's a funny little scene here where they're paying the check, and there is a really nice prop moment where Brian pulls out a gigantic money clip full of bills. It was a little bit of a clue that, okay, Brian's the rich one in the team.
Well, I think his wealth has been pretty well established, you know, with the company car and him not really caring about the condition it was in the first episode.
Right.
Having a loft apartment that's, you know, decked out and, hint, hint, Patrick, I feel like you might have found some inspiration with your home.
Oh, yeah.
I've noticed some neon lights too.
There's another cute little piece of physical acting, which I like. I've commented before on the physical scenes where the actors do something that is a little bit more than dialogue. And this was a tiny little one where it's just Brian and Emmett left in the booth. They have a cute little moment. And then Brian just playfully slaps Emmett in the back of the head. Emmett doesn't really react. He just dryly says,
"Don't touch me."
I was like, how much of that is Emmett and how much of that is Peter Page?
It was great, though. I like seeing these tiny little things, like Brian pulling out his money clip, whacking Emmett in the back of the head. These tiny little movements that show that the director was there, that they were actually doing a little bit more than just following the script.
Right. So Michael's had to leave the diner because he has to go back to work for his night of inventory with Tracy, who has volunteered her time to help.
Yeah. Mr. Novotny.
No, now it's Mike.
That's right. They graduated.
And I think in her attempt to flirt with him, she mentions how she's in the feminine product section of
feminine
the store.
Feminine hygiene.
And discussing how they're, what was it, that they're high and low,
light on heavy days and heavy on light days.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, that I'm sure that just stirs a whole lot in Michael right now. Interesting way to
he didn't react at all, though. He was
like straight up inventory done.
Yeah. Tracy works hard to get something out of him and says, nobody really knows you. And this little scene was pretty important because it was establishing that Michael isn't out. He doesn't share a lot with people at work. He went out with them once for drinks.
Yep.
And that was really it. They really, really don't know who he is. And Tracy starts to try to get something out of him.
Right. And you know, by kind of trying to crack open that layer, he's like, oh yes, there is something and you can't tell anyone. And I'm like, okay. So Tracy has now given you the perfect setup.
Right.
To just be open and honest about it. And I mean, granted, she probably will be disappointed, but at least you're not stringing her along. And what does he do? He comes up with some elaborate story about how he's a Superman or a superhero called Laser Man.
Not who I appear to be.
But you have to promise not to tell anyone. The truth is, when I was a boy, I was exposed to a laser light show at a Kiss concert. And after that, I developed a strange power to see into people's minds, to read their most private thoughts.
I'm going to rob a bank.
I'm going to blow up a bridge.
And since then, I set out to prevent crimes before they happened, and my real name is Laser Man.
What do you think Tracy was really hoping for? Because it almost seemed like she believed that there was a secret and she wanted to know the secret versus trying to just casually get to know somebody. So do you think that she suspected?
I don't know if it was that she suspected. I think it was her way of trying to say, like, I'm a person that you can be open with, you know, what mm-hmm. do you know? I think that was just a way of her trying to crack his shell, not necessarily to get him to say, are you gay or
yeah.
to be that specific? But I think she was definitely trying to see, like, are you vibing on what I'm vibing? Okay. Which he continues this terrible game with this poor girl. Yeah.
I did like his little stand up monologue there where he's, I'm going to rob a bank. I'm going to blow up a bridge. This is the only time we see Michael doing stand-up.
But he's very clearly thought about this. Well, I mean, granted, you know, Hal Sparks is a comedian, so that's probably why he was able to just bust that out.
Yeah.
But did you just have Laser Man in your back pocket? Is this just one of the many comic books you're hoping to write? Like,
yeah.
I was just like, you were more prepared for that than I thought.
His pratfall off the ladder, I thought, could have been done better.
So, Laser Man, what am I thinking?
We should probably get back to work.
Whoa!
Mike?
Because, it just kind of happens.
Well, he turned around as if he was going to walk away and then falls.
It was very Looney Tunes. Like, yeah. Wile E. Coyote walking off the cliff. And like, oh, he's still there. Oop, and there he goes.
I think it would have been better if Tracy had loved his little monologue and went in for a kiss. And that's what caused him to fall off.
That would have... Absolutely. Yeah.
There was a little subtle thing like, okay.
Cause she like grabs his hand at one point or grabs his arm and caresses.
Yeah. But there's no way that he could have been on that ladder and turned around, taken a step and fallen. Just saying. They could have done more
again,
with his fall.
Again, I think this is another moment that was just put in for convenience because we have another character to introduce.
Back at the bar, this episode jumps around quite a bit. There's a lot of kind of time shifting and just kind of scene to scene work. So at the bar, it's take your shirt off, get a free drink, I guess.
Yes, because Justin is very happily wanting to partake, even though he is only still 17 and can't actually drink. So he's just taking his shirt off to take his shirt off.
Yeah.
And you know, he goes to Brian and, I love the fact that he tells Brian like that. It's, you know, take your shirt off to get a free drink now or whatever.
Take your shirt off to get a free drink.
I don't show my tits for a watered down butt.
Get me a beer.
Get your own.
I'm too young.
Well, that's your problem.
Brian has been going to Woody's for longer than you've probably been alive. So I'm sure he is aware of what night it is. And, you know, Justin continues to play this little game of like, you know, you should get me a drink or I'm too young. Like it's to the point where I think his youthfulness, his mm-hmm. very youthfulness, is starting to wear a little thin on Brian. Like it's no longer a catch. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And maybe that's why the Justin character is kind of compelling throughout these early episodes is because he is all over the board and he goes from being the I like dick guy to
right.
Here comes my mom type
it's like,
of thing.
it was as if it's like that moment in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory when they open the doors to the factory and they start playing Pure Imagination. I feel like that's what happened as soon as Brian's dick went inside Justin. And you can just hear Willy Wonka.
Make a wish.
You know.
Hold your breath. Count to three.
So Justin is is shirtless in this bar, and all of a sudden here storms in Daphne.
Oh yeah,
of all people.
Wait, now does Daphne have a fake ID too?
I don't know how. I don't know how
that
she does.
Girl's everywhere.
Yeah, she. I mean, kind of like the way Justin is with Brian. Daphne's there with Justin, and I'm like. Who are you? Who let you in? Who is this doorman? Because they're not doing their jobs.
And somehow Justin's mother had gotten a hold of Daphne and tortured her until she gave up the story of where Justin is.
No, she explained it. So Jennifer had called Daphne's house and Daphne's mom answered before Daphne could get to it. And so her mom is the one who said, like, oh, no, Justin's not here.
So Jennifer just goes and picks up Daphne?
Here, no, show me where this gay bar is. I have a feeling Daphne's mom's like, where is he? You know, and got very Mama Bear about it and made her say where Justin was.
Daph?
Please don't kill me. It's not my fault.
Well, it's not your fault.
My mom answered. She said you weren't there. I didn't know what to do.
I don't know what you're talking about.
That's what,
but they show up at the bar together? Or do you think they came separately? Daphne shows up to try to warn Justin. And
this is a weird plot hole because, like, on the one hand,
she's 30 seconds ahead of Jennifer.
As if, like, I'm going to try and warn him. You can see, like, the Ferris Bueller trying to get back to his house in time. She's jumping over a fence in slow motion.
There's a lot to Daphne, though. We could explore in maybe a spinoff show.
She deserves her own episode. She does. She's a hoot and a half. I love her. He sees Daphne, and Daphne's trying to say, like, you don't understand. And he looks up and he sees his mother at Woody's.
Yeah.
And he's shirtless, and there are other men that are shirtless. There are pictures on the wall of shirtless men. I mean, it's just
Jennifer is like at a horror show.
Well, I mean, she's a good Christian woman, I feel.
Yeah.
So it's stimulus overload for Jennifer. And so Justin is like trying to bail as quick as he can, but Jennifer just wants to speak to him. And
where was Brian while this was going on? He was chasing after somebody, wasn't he?
He left. Yes, I think he was.
He left with somebody.
Yes, he did, because this comes up later. But as Brian leaves to go after whoever the dude was, we cut to see that Marvin is there talking to another a very attractive man. And it's like, oh,
right. We get that reveal that
Marvin,
realize
that that's going to come back later. So this is what you're talking about.
I think Marvin sees Brian leaving with that trick.
Yes. And the next thing we see is it's Brian in his apartment with that trick. And Justin is literally right behind him. And he
somehow gets through security too.
Again, you know what? I think they just have an open door policy. I mean, that's the only way to explain it. Everyone just shows up. And Justin is like thinking it's as if he's being chased by a serial killer. He's like,
right.
You know, he's like, she's stalking me or something like that. It's like, well, yeah, that's your mother. You're 17. You're out
grounded.
Alone. And you're underage at a bar.
Taking your shirt off to get free drinks from,
like, yeah,
from people.
She's
like
being
Marvin.
Your mother, Justin. You little shit.
Well, let's back up a little. Don't you think it might have been a nice little twist if Marvin would have bought Justin a drink too?
Oh, man. I feel like we need to go back in time and
be in
the writer's
show.
Room and be like, what if?
Yeah.
Let's give those notes in the writer's room and see what happens.
Back in the loft, Brian's trick started to get a little sassy when Justin showed up.
Why don't you get lost, you little asshole? I was here first.
Better yet, why don't you?
Beat it.
Fuck you.
Yeah. You're the bottom, remember?
And he got territorial.
Yeah.
He's like, no, that's my, like,
I was here first.
I was like, really?
Yeah. So
and
then
he calls him a little asshole. And I'm like, but he
dispatches that guy pretty quickly.
Yeah. And this is, he goes like, how about this? Why don't you go? And I'm like, wait a minute. Why is Brian territorial over Justin? Why would, like, because he literally spent so much time saying, you can't stay here. That's not my problem.
Yeah.
You know, all
now
these
like,
reasons to
come
say,
on in.
But as soon as someone else says, get the hell out, Brian's like, no, you go. And I'm like,
yeah,
wait
he
a
does
minute.
Go into protection mode pretty quickly with Justin. We've seen it a few times in earlier episodes where somebody will say something untoward about Justin, and Brian's pretty quick to make light of that. And at the same time point out, stop it.
Because then he just, after like still saying like, you can't really stay, he then says Justin can stay on the couch and to not dare jerk off on his couch. So I'm like, okay, but
yeah. And then all of a sudden, Brian's back at work the next day.
Right. And, you wanted to point out that spinning shot, which you loved. It made me dizzy. I was just like, up and up and up we go. And I'm like, okay, we need to stop now. Cause whoa.
Well, it had Brian on high. It had Marvin down low, and they had to, they had to kind of, one of them had to come down a little bit. The other one had to go up a little bit in order to meet in the middle. And Marvin, this scene with Marvin was pretty interesting. I'm going to use up one of my UK chips here.
Here we go. One.
This was directly lifted from the UK episode. The whole Marvin character was, I think the UK, of course, played it off a little bit better. But I like Marvin's line where they're talking about what they should do. And Brian's offering like tickets to the Pirates game. And Marvin says, the sort of evening that you might plan for yourself. And Brian's like, then he puts his arm around him. And I thought that was a little unexpected from Brian because...
Well, he found someone, he found something in common. He's like, oh, I can work with that.
Yeah, but he didn't know what was going on at that moment. So maybe Brian was calculating enough to realize, hey, I can take this guy out to Woody's or Babylon and close the deal. Well,
no, Marvin specifically says, oh, there's this club I hear about.
Oh, Babylon. Right.
So that's where he's like, aha. And so he's like, oh, I can work with another gay man. That's no problem at all. It's working with those straighties, those breeders that I can't stand.
Right.
And it's like, oh, okay. So that's, yeah, he finds camaraderie all of a sudden. He calls him, you old dog.
Why, Marvin, you old dog.
Yeah. The next day, I think it's the next day, we see Jennifer come into the diner for the first time.
You know what it reminded me of? The first time Justin steps foot into Babylon. It's overstimulating. Yeah. There's a lot of quick edits and fast cuts. There's a lot for Jennifer to take in. There's like the one real bitchy queen who like, as she tries to walk by, and he's like, he's giving all this look and all this face and all this hand about this woman who just like walked in front of him. And I'm like, what is he going to do? Like,
it reminded me of a Carnival Funhouse that she walked into where, you know, there's like the mirror that makes people fat and the other one that makes them like just distorted. And she's just looking around. She's in her pantsuit and she just doesn't know like what's going on in this new world.
Looks positively suburban, which I love. It's such a great contrast to Debbie because she's there to talk to Debbie, or she's there to try and find Justin, but she recognizes Debbie, who's decked out in all of the gay flair.
Yeah.
And her flaming red hair. And they actually have a wonderful heart to heart.
I love these scenes of Debbie and Jennifer, and I really chalk this up to the actors. So Sharon Gless, we've talked about before. We haven't talked about who plays Jennifer Taylor, which is Sherry Miller. She is so believable as a suburban mother, gay teenager.
I love every one of her appearances so far.
She ended up being in 31 episodes of the series, which is just short of half. So her talents as suburban mother of gay teenager were great. And the way that she evolves throughout the series is really wonderful.
Yeah, and every one of her appearances thus far, she has not been malicious. She's either been, you know, slightly ignorant. I think in the therapy session is probably the closest we've gotten to where she is just, I think, more trying to be protective mother than bigoted in any way. I don't see that in her. Like from the very beginning when she suspects that Justin's gay, she says, like, I won't tell your father. Like she wants to protect him. That's all she's interested in.
Yeah.
And so I found that whole scene just really touching and believable. And you might think it's cliche, but then you realize, like, for those of us who have like lived that kind of experience, one of the most truthful things that could possibly happen. And I think that's a real strong point in this episode.
In this scene really has to be played by two actors that can carry that. And this was where the writing met the actors, met the performance really, really well.
Yeah. And even then, and like after we get through all the fast editing and cut and fast cuts, and it's just sitting down and
these two dialogue. People talking. It was great. The dialogue can carry it.
And still threw in like a little bit of humor, you know, when she said, how about some, you know, she tries to get Jennifer to stay. She says, how about some coffee? And she's like, I'm off coffee.
Yeah,
of course you are. So she tries to get her some herbal tea, in which the tea, there was a condom inside, which...
Wait a minute. When you came to the studio today, you asked for tea.
I really
wanted
tea.
What were you looking for?
I didn't want the condom. I'm okay with that. I really wanted the tea. I would have loved to have had the get happy. It sounds so warm and inviting. Instead, I have a really delicious whiskey.
Yeah, well, pick one or the other, right?
Mm-hmm.
So here's the big moment, our big reveal that we have waited a long time for.
I'm so excited.
Dr. David Cameron.
Oh.
Hi. I'm Dr. Cameron.
Wow. The relief I feel now that we are at Dr. David Cameron is, I'm pretty sure, what Michael felt on that table.
The homoerotic chiropractor scene.
Oh my God.
I've never been to a chiropractor. Have you, Matt?
No, but I want to.
Do chiropractors mount the patient that way?
I think they have to in order to do the adjustments that they have to do.
We're going to have to look into this.
But like,
we looked into Trail Mix on behalf of our listeners. We need to look into how chiropractic sessions
we need to book some chiropractor appointments and report back, I think, by the time we get to the next couple of episodes. Because, you know, when he first when Dr. David Cameron enters, he's very put together, professional, older man. It's so interesting because I think they set him up to be an older man, like he's near 40 or something like that. But and I have to remember that Michael's my age, he's 28, 29. And
keep padding that one.
I am 29, I'm just saying.
28, 29. Gotcha.
Anyway.
Wait, I just sounded like Daphne there. Gotcha.
Gotcha.
I think that's where we need a soundbite of Daphne anytime we get one another. Gotcha.
Daphne just is my Daphne. Spirit guide.
Love it. And, you know, Dr. David Cameron, I think we were only going to call him Dr. David Cameron. Like, that's how he's going to be called every time he appears. he enters the room and Michael is awestruck at this.
Did Michael have his shirt off at that point? Or
yes, he did.
Did Dr. David ask him to disrobe?
Oh, no, he took his shirt off first.
Because then he says, okay, lay down on the table, and Michael plops right down.
Dr. David Cameron asks him, you know, like, what seems to be the problem, or like, how are you feeling? And he's like, oh, I'm fine. There's nothing wrong. He just like sputters out an answer. Mm-hmm. And Dr. David Cameron just goes up to his back and starts rubbing his shoulders. And I immediately was just like, I feel amazing right now. These beautiful masculine hands working my shoulders right now. And he's just like testing, like, how far can he bend it back?
This is how porn starts.
Oh my God. I'm like, I'm sure this is like a third of all porn scenarios. And he makes his adjustment and it's
just like collegeboyphysicals.com.
We should get sponsorship from them. As appointment progresses, he's on his back. Michael is on his back and he says, this is my favorite position. Just kidding. And gives him another adjustment. But there's that one point where Dr. David Cameron takes Michael in his masculine arms. And it looks like he's cuddling him at some point. They're very close together.
I'm just going to be quiet and listen to your description of the scene for a minute.
he's holding him and Michael's just taking him in. And then he gets like another adjustment. And then Dr. David Cameron asks, okay, go ahead and roll over. And Michael, on a dime, flips himself over as if to like present himself and to say, I'm ready.
And have we identified that Michael's a bottom by now?
I think he's versatile, but in this moment he was cleaned out and ready. Dr. David Cameron just climbs on top and he's like on top of Michael.
Even if that wasn't real, if it was just for dramatic effect,
I hope it's real.
It worked. That scene just worked.
It worked.
Michael felt too great to be able to get up.
Is something wrong? Something I should look at? Or?
No. I feel great. Too great.
Don't be embarrassed. Happens all the time.
I'm sure it does, Dr. David Cameron.
I did like that Dr. David knew what he had just caused.
Again, happens all the time.
Yeah. Meanwhile, at Babylon, the big dick contest is going on, which is just
Are we still talking about Dr. David Cameron? Because I'm assuming he's part of this big dick contest.
Now. Do you need to open your whiskey there?
I do. Just ignore me.
So the big dick contest ends up being a little bit of a cover for Marvin and Brian to have their little interplay. The the Big Dick Contest, of course, is being hosted by a catty drag queen. And
as all Big Dick Contests are.
Yeah, this was years ahead of its time.
Yeah, absolutely. years ahead of the Spin Shower Contest, which is now hosted at Charlie's. Things like that. But what's amazing is that in this scene, the first thing we hear is Marvin showing pictures of his kids.
Right. First at Babylon.
So we know that Marvin is married with children. But
why does Brian even care? You know, it served a purpose because it furthered the story of Brian and his own kid with Marvin and his kids. So our theme is coming back in here.
Well, I think now that he found commonality with Marvin, that he's like, I feel a little more comfortable that I can do what I have to get him as a client.
Yeah.
You know, so like, yeah, I'll listen to him talk about his kids. I'll give him a little sass because he's into it and be fine. No, of course.
I think Brian would have, because Marvin propositions Brian. I think that the Brian that we know, absolutely would have done it for the money, but it was strung along for the point of the story.
Right. And I have to say, there was that little interplay that was happening on the stage at the Big Dick Contest with that drag queen saying, like, all entries have to be at least six inches.
Yeah.
And I'm like, 5 1/8 is very specific. I also have questions about whether or not this was flaccid or if this was erect.
Yeah, or where the end point of the ruler.
Yes, who is determining where the base is?
Yeah.
I have a lot of questions about the logistics and the credibility of
the
such
mechanics
a contest.
Of the measurement.
Yes.
So that scene just kind of wrapped up all of a sudden, and Michael's back at work at the Q-Mart. And Dr. David shows up. Did you think it was creepy that Dr. David stalked Michael to his workplace?
I don't think he stalked him. I think
he wasn't there shopping. He had no basket. He wasn't looking for any particular goods.
But it's also been established that we're living in a world that is without smartphones, apps, things like that. So they're trying to have a meet cute. He knew where he worked because Michael revealed that at his appointment. And
Dr. David admits that he came there to see him too. I just thought it was like a little creepy. If my doctor showed up at my workplace, I'd be like, what are you doing here? I'd
call the police. Looked like Dr. David Cameron.
Okay, fair enough.
I would be like, hello.
Did you bring your chiropractic table with you?
I'll go wherever we need to.
Like, yes.
I'm very okay with this. And I love the fact that this happens right in front of Tracy. You know, she gets him this like, get
was
well
it
basket.
Tracy or was it?
Yes, it was Tracy. It was
Tracy. Marlene.
No, Marlene makes comments about, you know, them staying late or whatever.
Oh, no, didn't Marlene come over and yell about kids climbing up a soda dispenser and then gives Dr. David this lusty look?
Exactly, yes. I mean, again, Dr. David Cameron is incredible.
Marlene
attractive.
Delivers once again. Good casting on the extras.
Oh, yeah, she was fantastic. She was a bitch. I'm looking at all of her behavior. I'm like, I'm sure you would have been written up.
Yeah.
5 or 6 times by the time you entered the building, you know, unless maybe I'm in like a different kind of corporate world, because some of the behavior at that big queue is just inappropriate.
We all should work there. It sounds fun.
Hard pass. I've already worked at Marshall's. I'm okay. So we now know that Dr. David Cameron has come to the Big Queue Mart to ask Michael out, which Michael seemed still somewhat oblivious on, and he's just like, wait, you're, and he's like, yeah,
and I hope you are too.
And he's like, I have to be very careful.
Yeah,
they don't know about me here.
It was that moment where it was this cute little scene where they bonded over Michael having to be discreet at work, and then Dr. David kind of saying, ah, I get it, okay, let's go to dinner instead. Smooth operator.
Right. So we now know that, so we have to check in on Justin and his mother, because Justin's mother has made somewhat of a scene after having a really wonderful discussion with Debbie. She finds Justin at school and is driving and trying to get his attention, and he just continues to walk away, and she gets out and yells at him.
How embarrassing.
Right. I'm like, this is a 17-year-old boy whose mother is screaming at him in front of everyone, but she's saying it because it's what he needs to hear.
Stop running from me, because I'm not running from you.
And this is, again, why I love Jennifer, and she's like, she doesn't care about how it looks. She's like, I just want you to know that you're my son and I still love you. And it's a wonderful scene, and I feel like it's incredibly truthful, and again speaks to that feeling that Justin's coming out experience is probably markedly different from what Brian had.
Yeah, and once again, Sherry Miller is so believable in her lines, which could be delivered in a very corny way, but they're not. You really believe that this character feels that, and
Right. It's like it's not a moment of desperation of just trying to say what he needs to hear. You really can tell, like, deep down, that she's pleading with him.
Yeah,
and it feels completely earned.
And then, unbeknownst to her, they go to the art museum.
And she's trying to have this wonderful heart to heart. And she's like, oh, this one painting, and it's of a baby. Is it being bathed or something like
that? Yeah. And she like says, that. It's my favorite.
It reminded her of Justin as a child. And meanwhile, Justin is cruising the art museum. and I saw that, this guy who's...
Which, by the way, cruising art museums, great place to meet guys.
I've never cruised an art museum.
Art Patrick. Institute of Chicago.
Can you tell us more?
No.
There's no elaboration on that, Patrick.
But no, we'll just let that one hang there for a minute.
Great. Okay. hang like one of the paintings.
So Justin immediately captures the bleach blonde with the roots growing out guy.
And that necklace. I mean, he might as well have had puka shells.
Were those puka shells?
They looked like puka shells. They were not quite puka shells, but I was like, you might as well.
Were they cowrie shells like Brian's bracelet? I don't remember.
They were something. But they go into the bathroom.
I loved how this was almost a shot by shot recreation of
Brian taking the client in. Yes. Yep. Yeah. I think we're seeing a lot. There's a lot of mirrored action.
Yeah.
In this episode.
Do you think Justin top that guy?
I think so.
Go Justin.
I think Justin is exploring the full spectrum of his sexuality, and I think that's really wonderful. He's what, probably like a month out of being a virgin and already understands the finer tactics of cruising in public.
The way that Kari Skoglund was cutting back and forth between the scene in the stall and Jennifer Taylor admiring her painting. Favorite painting.
It was fantastic. It was really fantastic. And it was like, and it's clear that Jennifer is very aware of what is happening.
Yeah.
She clocks it. She knows what's going on.
But it wasn't, and I say this a lot, Kari Skoglund did not make a meal out of it. There was enough left in Jennifer's look to say, yeah, I think she's got it. And then you're like, oh, wait, does she? Wait, does she? And that is really what made the scene, because you don't know if she really, really, really understands it, because she doesn't want to know what Justin's doing in public, yet she kind of knows. And that's why the scene really worked for me.
Yeah. So
meanwhile,
we leave Justin to his trickery in the art museum bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's so excited about Michael's date.
Yeah.
With Dr. David Cameron. And they're all discussing, like, what is he going to wear? Where is he taking him? And we find out that Dr. David Cameron is taking Michael to an expensive restaurant. And he's ready to wear like this plaid button-down shirt and jeans. And Emmett, being the retail whore that he is, or a men's stylist, I guess is the way he put it, determines that he is going to help Michael look good for this date. Cut to
Brian's apartment, print top.
And he opens the door, and what the hell is Michael wearing?
The orange pants really worked. Brian had the great line, who did this to you?
Who did this thing to you? Let me guess. Emmett De La Renta.
And it's like, in what way did Emmett think that was a good idea? Like,
yeah. Well, here's also where something didn't work for me, where Michael's talking about going on this date and he says he doesn't know what to do or what to say. Again, this is a 30-year-old man, 29, 30-year-old. How can he not know how to go out and socialize one-on-one with somebody?
Think about what he does every weekend. He goes out to clubs. He is doing drugs. He is doing the hookup thing. Going on an actual date has not entered his periphery in who knows how long. So, like, he's operating.
Brian does all that, and he could carry himself on a date. So
Michael is definitely not Brian.
But this is just sort of common sense, because it's not hard to engage with somebody one-on-one. I mean, they're going to a restaurant. They're going to have dinner. They're going to have drinks. It's not fundamentally different from Michael's everyday life.
Well, the other thing is that Michael is going on a date with an older man who, until recently, was his caretaker. So there's some patient, physician.
And or molester.
Yeah. I consent.
I did like, I think it's Brian's line where he says, if he's buying you an expensive dinner, you have to put out.
That is not true, Brian Kenny.
Yeah, totally. Brian like dressed him up in his own clothes.
I hated it.
Well, I like the way that Brian was making this attempt to turn Michael into himself as a way to like carry him through the date.
That's why I did not like it. He
was setting him up for failure, I think.
Absolutely. And I think because what he did is he did what he believed to be the polar opposite of what Emmett did. But in fact, he, instead of doing a 180, he did a 360, and he just went right. He did exactly what Emmett did, just in the other direction, by making him so cold and calculated like Brian is.
Well, once again, though, we talked about this in the last episode where Michael's at dinner and he's just a complete klutz at everything that he's doing. And again, how can somebody in their late 20s not be able to handle this? He's wide-eyed at Dr. David taking a taste of his wine. His Diet Pepsi is excellent.
Okay, yeah, let's go ahead and break down this date, because Dr. David Cameron orders...
I kind of wanted to be on that date. I wanted to be the Michael on that date.
Oh, my God.
I could have pulled it off.
I would have had no problem, because Dr. David Cameron would have had me putty in his hands by that night. Because Dr. David Cameron orders this wine, this bottle of wine, assuming to share.
A 61 Petrus, which is probably one of the rarest wines.
61 Petrus.
That you can buy right now.
That was bottle it, was it rare sell. In 2000 or 2001?
Oh, yeah. That bottle would sell for about $20,000 in a restaurant.
Oh, my God. I would have said, screw the Diet Pepsi.
But Michael doesn't know it. And so it fits with the script. But nobody's going to know about a 61 Petrus unless you work in the industry.
Sure. But like the fact that he orders a Diet Pepsi, and it's not just that he ordered the Diet Pepsi, but the fact that it comes with a straw that bends.
Yeah.
What? What kind of restaurant is this where they can have one of the most expensive wines you could possibly buy? And
they were both dressed pretty casually also.
Oh, well, no, Dr. David Cameron had a nice blazer. I was into it.
No tie, though. It wasn't matching. He wasn't wearing a suit. And Michael's wearing a black leather jacket.
I think they had to at least wear a jacket.
Black leather. They bound over eBay. Michael's buying a 1960 Flash comic.
But I will say, I had to, again, go back to the wine, because I was obsessed with the moment that the waiter handed Dr. David Cameron the cork, and he just sniffed it. And I was just like, take me now. Oh, my God. Everything Dr. David Cameron was doing was right.
So wait, have you replaced Bad News Blake with Dr. David Cameron?
Oh, 100%. Because Dr. David Cameron has not tried to drug me. He is literally whining and dining me. I'm very happy. I'm very into it. And they during the day, they start talking about Brian, and I want to be like, Michael, shut up. Mm-hmm. It's not about Brian. It's about you. Dr. David Cameron is interested in you. You know,
I want to use my second UK chip here. Oh, Lord.
Okay. That's two.
The UK version was better, of course. Interestingly, Vince, who is the Michael equivalent, his date was named Cameron.
Was it a Dr. Cameron David?
No, he was an accountant.
Oh. Accountant doesn't get me going like doctor. Sorry to all the accountants out there.
So they finish their meal. They get into Dr. David's Jaguar, and they pull up in front of Michael's place, and Michael goes to blow Dr. David. I mean, who wouldn't, right?
Correct.
Dr. David shoos him off, says, get off me.
I'm like, I definitely don't think Dr. David Cameron would have minded the kiss. But it's the assumption that, because this is what Brian told Michael, well, I have to put out. So here I go, mm-hmm. and down he goes. And I love that Dr. David Cameron stops him.
What are you doing?
Don't you want to...
I asked you out because I wanted to get to know you better, not because I wanted a quick fuck.
Yeah.
As if that,
how cute.
But what Michael takes from that is that he's like undesirable in some way. I'm like, no, he's just treating you with respect. Like, has it really been that long, Michael?
So that's the end of their date. And he gets out and he thinks he made a fool out of himself.
He did.
And there's a couple cutscenes where we see Melanie and Lindsay in their 40 cloves stuffed into a chicken, waiting for Brian to show up. But why do you think Brian skipped that dinner?
Well, because he had a client that he had to provide services.
But it was staged up as an early dinner so that you can still go to the clubs. So there was a little gap here in the script, and there's a line that Brian had said, which is, I always come when I say I'm going to. With double entendre, sure, but he didn't show up for the lesbian dinner.
Well, also, can we talk about when he comes to that hotel room to see Marvin?
Oh, yeah.
When he opens the, like,
an underwear check here.
Before the underwear check, because I have to talk about it. Let's talk about Let's talk about the bellhop that's walking out of the room.
I didn't see that. Tell me about that.
Yes, okay. So, as Brian's like about to knock or just knocks on the door is open slowly and an attractive young bellhop walks out.
Was he delivering the champagne?
It could be that, but Marvin makes a comment going like, I wasn't sure if you were going to show up. And so then I'm wondering if the bellhop was option two for Marvin.
Ooh.
That like, if he doesn't show up, well, at least he's going to pound one guy tonight and it's going to be the bellhop. And that was my question. But you didn't see it. And so I'm like,
I'm going to have to go back and watch that part.
Yes, you have to go back and we will recap that moment, because in my mind, when I saw it, I was like, oh, the bellhop just narrowly missed getting pounded.
Well, and then Marvin makes his move on Brian.
Yes.
Tells Brian to take his clothes off and
do it slowly.
Yeah. So Brian's pulling his pants down. He has no underwear on. So there's.
So what do we do when we want to do an underwear check, but there's no underwear?
How do you rate
that?
I guess we can't call that an official underwear check, but I love that double shot where there's like Brian's ass on the left and you see Marvin on the right, and Marvin's like crawling across the floor on his hands and knees just when the phone rings.
and it's his wife saying something has happened to his daughter, and she like wants him to come home, but he's saying like, you tell her that I love her and I'll see her in the morning or something like that. And it's like, he might as well like, daddy's got some dick to get, you know? But
fair enough.
Brian hears this, sits down in the chair naked, grabs a bottle of champagne and is hearing this conversation, wants nothing else to do with it. And Marvin tries to go back to business as usual. Mm-hmm. And Brian shuts it down.
Suddenly Brian has all these morals, which initially I thought, okay, that's a little out of character for Brian, who will fuck anybody. But
I will tell you what I think is the crack in this veneer that Brian has. I think it's a combination of Justin entering his life and Gus entering his life.
Yeah.
I really think the combination of those two, like I think in Justin, he sees himself at that age, mm-hmm. and then he sees in his own son an opportunity to do the things that were right that maybe his parents did not, and he's seeing this experience of what Marvin is obviously doing to his children, that he wants to break out of that And like they might as well have played like the Hurricane as he walked out, you know, with his bare ass hanging out.
He did. He left pants the hotel room
over
naked.
His shoulder. And Marvin is like claiming like, oh, you're gonna get in so much trouble for this. And you're like, what are you gonna tell them when you tell them I didn't sign with you? He's like, I'll just tell them we couldn't provide services you required or something.
Wouldn't it have been great when Brian opened the door to leave if the bellhop was like kind of with his ear up against the door?
I'm also convinced that the reason why Brian stayed naked is because he was going to go fuck the bellhop.
Good little tangent there. So Brian takes off and shows up at Melanie and Lindsay's house. And for once, we see Lindsay get pissed at Brian. Normally, she is very subservient to Brian and,
right, and this
sycophantic
is what-
towards his weirdness, but... She was only pissed for a minute.
Right. And it was like, she's like, you know what? Even I tried to give you the benefit of the doubt and you still fucked up.
Right.
And then we know that we then cut to Babylon because, again, it's near the end of the episode.
Yeah, everything ends
at
Babylon.
We got to get to Babylon. And Michael is going off on how the date went. And he's like, he's out to find someone who will find him, who wants him. And it's like, well, no, Dr. David Cameron wants you.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not expecting you to give it up to him just because he took you out on one date.
Yeah, and Michael's like so wound up, he has to go get off in the back room.
Right, and I'm just like, it bugged the hell out of me. I wanted to smack Michael. I thought he was acting childish and was just somehow lacked any nuance of what Dr. David Cameron was trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so to watch him act that way helped the mirroring of what all the behavior we've seen in Brian, because he's acting like a real tool and he's moving his way through to the back room to get to find someone who will want him. And this is where we have a really interesting juxtaposition. And I even wrote down, I feel like he becomes Brian. He loses like anything in his eyes. He just looks sort of glazed over.
Mm-hmm.
He has one goal in mind. He goes back there. He takes in all the men. And like, this is where I think the back room showed a little more of the graphic nature of it. I think there's a lot more in the sound design. There's a lot more moaning. I think we get even some clear shots of like there's penetration happening. And he finally pulls up to this one guy.
Yep. And the whole time, Sexy Boy by the Kinky Boys is playing underneath that scene. And
appropriate.
It's jumping back and forth between Brian and Gus and Michael and Trick. And it's so tragic that in the streaming version, you get an entirely different creepy song that's happening.
What's the creepy song?
Completely changed the scene.
What the hell? it's creepy because I understand it maybe when it's working with Michael in the back room,
but yeah,
to then play that over like this tender moment of Brian with Gus and Lindsay looking at this like
it looked like Brian was fatherly about to eat Gus.
It's like, take wait, a bite, Patrick, have you seen Mother? Have you seen Mother yet? Because that's what I think was going to happen.
The desire to continue to monetize the show, we respect, because we wouldn't be doing this podcast without it still being on Netflix. But it's entirely fucked up without the original music. There was so much thought put into the music supervision of the original show, and it's a shame that those episodes aren't airing on Netflix and Showtime.
We're not getting the way that scene truly should have played, you know?
But this is where the scene ends.
Yeah. And just like Michael getting pleasured by this random guy, and the camera and it just fades out on his face. Just, there's nothing happening there anymore.
So our conclusion, does this episode hold up? So for me, I'm going to say yes. there were two competing storylines going on, the young storyline and old. So we have Michael and Dr. David, Brian and Marvin, and then Brian and Justin. Those stories still play out today. The only heavy lifting in this episode was really Justin and his mother. Everything was predictable, but we can still call it relevant. So my vote is yes on this episode.
I think it's 100% relevant. And I think I probably liked the stuff between Justin and Jennifer more than you did. I think we see her missteps. We see his missteps. We can see that she's clearly trying and she's dealing with a bit of a spoiled brat of a kid who is finally engaging in his own independence. So I found the stuff that they were doing played out really, really well. And I also really loved that juxtaposition of the relationship between Brian and Marvin with that generational gap and what it means to someone like Brian, who is out and proud, to Marvin, who had got married young and had kids, and he feels like it was too late before he could clearly come out, and so only does his business when he's out on business, to then also play that against what's going on between Dr. David Cameron and Michael, who... You're still
warmed up over Dr. David.
Yeah, like I'm literally feeling warm, and I hope I can make his appointment book within the next couple of days so he can adjust me. Mm.
So this episode, props to Jason Schaefer, writer, and Kari Skoglund. Two thumbs up from us. Next time, we will talk about episode 6, The Art of Desperation. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez. See you next week.
Thanks for listening. Leave a like, share with a friend, and subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.
Hey, Todd, how's it going?
Fine.